Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Dodi Bellamy. She has done a collection of her, well, I don't know what to call them. Officially, they're being called essays. And if I were being asked to nominate one essay I've read this year for a special award, it would be Dodi Bellamy's essay, Phone Home. It's about her mother's death, done by way of an analysis of E.T. As it happens, Dodi and her mother watch E.T. when the mother is dying. An extraordinary spike of memory leads you to recall that you watched it when your grandmother was dying, too. E.T. becomes, in the essay, like an angel of death to enunciate the loss of a loved one. And the whole piece blooms into this marriage of analysis, essay, personal memoir, poem, and that defines what the pieces are like in this new book, called When the Sick Rule the World, which is published by Semia Text. What do you consider these? Are they essays? Are they meditations do you have?
Well, I know what you're saying. I'm always writing things. I don't know what to call it. But I'm fine calling them essays, because if you go back to like Montaigne, the essay was a very open form that examined the working of his mind, and so it could go anywhere. And I think the essay, in some sense, in this sense, is like the closest prose comes to poetry.
Yes. In these pieces, you use art, both popular art and avant-garde art, to reveal our personal emotions. Dodi is one of the rare writers who's capable of transforming analysis to something beyond analytic intellect to passion and recollection, memory, and it seems as if part of the job you have is to take the reader by the hand past mere intellect into something emotionally complex and real.
Yeah, that's been my goal ever since I was a young writer. Yeah, I started out when I was learning my craft, it was just all emotion. And then I sort of encountered the whole idea of adding, well, in San Francisco in the 80s and 90s, when I was learning to be a writer, there was a big emphasis on theory and intellect. And so I started incorporating those elements in to survive socially. But I never wanted to like have them take over the work. You know, I think that we all experience the world through our bodies and through our emotions, and the emotion and the bodies are not separated. And so I think because of class issues, I always wanted to have a writing that was and smart. It's important for me to be considered smart. But I wanted it to be accessible to a wide range of people. Didn't want to speak down to anybody.
Now, this is a piece called Center of Gravity. It is inspired by a show by the artist Marc de Souvreau. Can you say just a little bit about who he is for people who haven't seen his work?
They had a show of his in San Francisco at Crissy Field, they're outdoors, and he creates these gigantic steel arched sculptures that look very elegant and as if they couldn't possibly, like they're going to collapse, but they're all very well balanced.
And since you grew up in the heart of steel, in the center of gravity of the steel mill world, there's a immediate personal response to someone who's trying to make steel balletic. And that's what we find in this piece, The Center of Gravity, by my guest, Dodie Bellamy.
Steel is an incredibly cooperative substance, I read in an art review. Marc de Souvreau's mammoth creations won't tumble or crumble under their own weight, I read. He loves to sneer at gravity. He creates joy of spirit out of steel. He's like an acrobat feeling for that invisible point, a steel whisperer, madly in love with the brawny alloy, coaxing it into graceful forms, Tyrannosaurus-sized, carnival orange, energetic and muscular, yet seeming to defy gravity, like a multi-ton dancer who has lighted on the lawn. Steel geometries connect earth and sky, space and time. Primordial elements, physics, music, poetry, philosophy find their way into the mix, de Souvreau's wizardry melding the monumental and the intimate, humanizing steel. Over and over, I read, feisty, gravity-defying, bright. In the Rust Belt where I was raised, there was no poetry in steel, no art, no music. Steel meant money. Steel meant hellish, smokestacks spitting fire and black clouds. In grade school, they showed us a movie about the making of steel so that we would understand where our fathers and uncles went to all hours of the day and night, returning with blackened hands impossible to clean. At 3,000 degree Fahrenheit, the air turns a hazy orange, and the solidest things, automobiles, boxcars, melt and seethe. Molten metal flaring in huge cauldrons. Molten metal glowing white, coroned by yellow, coroned by orange. The skin of goggled bin liquid with sweat, men wincing like marshmallows at a friggin' campfire. I sat there in my grade school desk chair staring at the pull-down screen, terrified by the mill's liquid fire, terrified of the molten center of the earth, the molten beginning of the universe, of the unremitting fires of hell they told us about every Sunday. Hell was a steel mill that boiled through all eternity, grimy men prodding an unimaginably hot vat of vile, bubbling goo. My brother operates a crane at Inland Steel, which means he uses levers and dials to lift and move things that weigh many tons. I imagine him hovering above the mill in a small windowed box. Through the window, he looks down at the glowing, spitting, steaming vats. The hinge that holds the box cracks, and my brother's cage plummets into a thick, frenetic brew, incinerated as it sucked into a lurid orange and yellow downward spiral. This isn't accurate, but I can't eradicate this image of my brother hovering precariously above a raging inferno. Yellow and white sparks, white clouds, tons of hot danger, red and yellow smoke. I feel my face melting. That's why you go to college, so you don't have to do this stuff. Orange, yellow, white, glow, spark. The crane my brother operates is a bridge crane. Parallel rails are attached to elevated wall structures. The bridge is a beam that runs between the two rails. A trolley with a hoist mechanism moves back and forth along the bridge. My brother sits in the trolley. It's air-conditioned in there, so it's considered a cushy job. My brother got bladder cancer when he was 40, a disease, he tells me, that old men get. He blames the steel's toxic fumes. My brother is used to working double shifts for weeks on end and the huge double-time salary that brings in. It's cheaper to pay the overtime than hire more people because of the cost of benefits. Now that the mill has been bought by the Japanese, his hours and his benefits have been cut. Regardless, he remains a staunch Republican because Democrats kill jobs. In the mill, only blacks and Hispanics vote Democrat. Men enter the steel mill clean and exit roasted, exhausted, covered in grime. Men take their paychecks across the street to the casinos, who await them 24 hours a day. Most mills in northern Indiana have closed. My brother works in the sole remaining mill. He's a crane operator. I keep trying to make this more poetic, but I can't. A mine like a steel refinery, prosaic and terrible. I had the tackiest of childhoods, but it was not poor. The steel of nails and hammers and organized labor kept our family in Sears Roebuck abundance, reaches for gravity-defying feats, feisty, gravity-defying bright. Gravity does not bend. Art writers lie. Art lies. It was the lie of art I wanted more than anything else as a child. I lived in notebooks, lying on my bed, writing feverishly along their cool blue lines. While in the living room, my father, the carpenter, smokes and cusses, and Mom's in the kitchen, and my brother is out engaging in the juvenile delinquent behavior that will make him a high school dropout. In my notebooks, I dreamed I knew Latin, and I lived in the Alps, where I hovered above the world craneless, educated and beautiful, with a mind lofty and brilliant enough to defy.
Tony Bellamy, reading Center of Gravity. I love that last sentence and the way in which brilliant enough to defy leaves implied brilliant enough to defy gravity, because that's been the subject of the piece throughout. And suddenly you have defied gravity by not mentioning her.
Uh-huh. That's interesting.
It's a beautiful way of ending the piece. You're listening to Bookworm, and my guest is Dodie Bellamy. Now, I find these pieces to be incredibly well organized. What we just heard, it seems to me, is in a four-part arc. The De Souvero sculpture itself, with a extraordinary poetic description of how these Tyrannosauruses are built, followed by taking us into Indiana, into the classroom when Dodie is young, seeing a movie about the making of steel. That gets poeticized into the nightmare of steelworking as hell. Then it goes to your family, in particular to your brother, who's in the second generation of steelwork. He has a cushy job inside an air-conditioned crane. And then, finally, Dodie fantasizing the cushiest job imaginable, the making of art, and that fear always that destiny holds the steel mill ahead of us, and that anything else, art, making poetry, might be a lie, that we might be striking out into an unknown that doesn't exist. And that's been your career. It's been sort of amazing.
Yeah. Well, I actually pretty much achieved this dream that's in this piece because my entire life is involved with writers and artists. I teach creative writing. So it's kind of a hermetic environment of art. And the older I get, the more I think about what I lost by leaving those working class roots. And I hold on to the value of the working class roots and wish and feel this almost like nostalgia for it, even though I know that I could not go back there or would want to go back there and live. And the version of the working class that I hold nostalgia for doesn't even exist anymore. So I really feel that this need to be loyal to it. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. And what I find in this collection, which is called When the Sick Rule the World, and it's published by Semiotext, what I find in this collection is, on the one hand, the yearning for a return, which is there in the return to the mother when she's dying. You go back home to be with her, and you both can and can't. The best mediation is watching E.T. together.
Yeah.
On the other hand, in San Francisco, as you said, you're dealing with a world of people who became very involved with philosophical literary theory, with intellect. You're a straight-ish woman living in a largely gay male collective of writers, or at least that was a place that you went to after an initial involvement with feminist writers. And the whole sense in this book, beautifully done, wherever she goes, Dodie is alone. And so I found the pieces in this book very interesting in their battle to maintain the essence of Dodie Bellamy and the revelation of a world that's poised on the attempt to remove the Dodiness from Dodie.
Yeah, I think that's very insightful, Michael. And the book ends with a long meditation on the tech invasion of San Francisco and seeing my neighborhood dissolving while I'm still in it. I feel like I'm becoming extinct, and my whole community is becoming extinct and very, very rapidly. So
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Dodie Bellamy about her book, When the Sick Rule the World. We'll continue after this short break.
Take KCRW with you on one of our mobile apps, available for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry devices. Stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and our News 24 and Eclectic 24 streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Dodie Bellamy about her recent book, When the Sick Rule the World, a look into marginal groups through the new narrative style that Dodie Bellamy has helped to perfect that combines memoir, essay, story, poem, meditation. It's a very free-form response. In the final piece, you are doing an analysis of your neighborhood in San Francisco. And suddenly, as the piece comes to a highly poised and poetic finish, sort of like Joyce's description of the snow at the end of The Dead, you announce, "I don't think this piece is over yet." And you start again with a suitcase that's found in the neighborhood that contains the chopped up body of an unknown victim. And because, as you have said in the first part of the essay, you're so much a part of this neighborhood, you've lived in it for so long, you can imagine that you've seen someone carrying this suitcase, that you know the bearer as well as his victim, and you start to do research, and suddenly we become aware that there's a new fold of essay writing, hypothetical analysis. And it's so exciting to read as you enter the field of this crime zone that can only be understood because you know what this neighborhood is, what's happening to the poor people as they're being asked to leave, as the single occupancy hotels shut down. And so we enter with Dodie as our representative the analysis of a crime, and it becomes a whole new possibility of what you're doing in the essay. Is that real? Did you suddenly feel that the piece was not finished?
Oh, totally. You know, I had that, you're right, I had this kind of romantic, lush ending. And then the suitcase with the body parts appeared, and I had spent so much time working on this piece. And, you know, I felt really grossed out. It was horrifying. But as the writer part of me is going, I can't believe God gave me this, you know, like, and I everyone in the neighborhood, and I think in the city in general, became obsessed with this story. And since a lot of the piece is about the homeless, and it's a homeless man who is rolling the suitcase around, ultimately it's found out it's a homeless man in the suitcase. And I think that with all the pain of gentrification and that sense of upheaval, that the suitcase became this like kind of psychological correlative for all this other fragmentation and kind of sense of violation. And I didn't want to make that, though, like too obvious. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yes, well, but it becomes very exciting. The piece is called In the Shadow of Twitter Towers. What's the name of this part of San Francisco where Twitter has established its offices?
It's Mid-Market in San Francisco, but it's on one side of Market is South of Market, and that's the neighborhood I live in, South of Market. So, yeah, Twitter moved a block and a half from my rent-controlled Victorian apartment.
Yes, and the body that has been carved up becomes like the city that gets carved up and becomes like the essay form being carved up and interrupted. Nothing, neat endings are no longer available, and that's part of what's exciting. You interrupted a completed book in order to bring in what was happening that day, that week, that month in the news of the place you live.
Yeah, I think, though, that's always the case with my writing. Like, it becomes sort of a magical process, you know, where you start reading the world differently and you're like this shaman and all. So there's all these accidental things that happen. And you hear this a lot when biographers, for instance, talk about writing a biographer, and they'll be sitting next to their subject's cousin on the bus and just meet them. You know, like these magical things happen. So I started going into this sort of magical thinking at the end. It was fun because kind of this controlled madness that you allow yourself to go into.
Dodie Bellamy, in response to William Burroughs, William Burroughs invented a form called the cut-up. He would cut up his writing into slices and rearrange it and then retype the rearrangements, and he called this cut-ups. Well, Dodie Bellamy added an N to create a word from Cut Up that we cannot say on the radio. And what we have in that suitcase, that's a Cut Up too. And the pieces, yes, they use theory, in quotes, as you say, it's an objective correlative. That's the language of literary criticism, but at the same time, it goes beyond it. We discover that what we know about the world, theoretically, is also manifested in the world actually. And it seems to me that that's what makes the best of these essays so very strong.
Yeah, I think one of the most exciting things about writing is that it's a way to read the world. Like we walk through the world with these blinders on, but when you're writing, suddenly the blinders are gone and you're wide-eyed and you're kind of screwy looking and all these things come together and it makes this new sense, this new meaning. It gives the illusion of meaning. I don't really know if I believe there's meaning in the world, but while I'm writing it, it just, meaning feels very rich.
Well, you mentioned that you tell your students that by going to these uncomfortable places, these moments that have not yet been described, that you are arriving at the possibility of the new. That experimental writing, I guess, isn't experimental because of difficulty. It's experimental because you're experimenting with your life, with perception, and with entering the world that has been previously unexplored by writing. Is that right?
Yeah, and I would say that the relationship to form and writing and reality is that certain forms in themselves create a certain version of reality, like your conventional narrative. You have a beginning, a middle, and an end, and it's all summed up nicely. And like, how does that work in the world we live in? You know, like I just basically go at form in a very intuitive way, and whatever material I'm working in, it all starts kind of molding it like a sculpture. Like, how can I create a form of writing? Because I believe all writing has to have some formal structure or the reader's just going to get lost in it. And I don't want anybody to get lost.
I've been talking with Dodie Bellamy, author of When the Sick Rule the World, published by Semia Text in their Active Agent series. Thank you, Dodie, for joining me.
Thank you.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from When the Sick Rule the World at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My associate producer is Alan Howard. The technical director is J.C. Swadek. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Salman Rushdie is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.